Good morning.
Good morning, Jill.
It's just you and me. Hi.
And Sarah. Sarah's here.
Good afternoon. This is Sandra Moon from Maryland.
Hi. Welcome, Sandra.
Thank you. I'm taking Tom's place, I guess.
Yeah, I sent NIAAA something about that yesterday. I don't think it's going to be a problem.
Okay. All right, well, just let me know if you need anything from me.
Well, he'll have to go through the official channels because...
Yeah.
Hi, Bill's here.
Trying to figure out my life here.
Good luck.
Yeah. All right. Let's see. All right. I know that Sarah's on. Jennifer's on. Sandra Mooney is on. Okay. Who else is on?
This is Christy and Cristiano.
Hi.
Is it really cold there?
Not really. It's in the 30s.
Yeah.
Well, that's not bad.
Helen Gisbert.
Hi, Helen.
Hello.
Hey, Ed. Bill Dunty's on.
Hey, Bill. How are you?
Good.
We last talked.
Yeah, I think a few
Dale is up for the holidays. All right. How about Claire, Joanne, Jeff, Johan, Scott, Ken,
Joanne?
Scott's here.
Joanne is here.
Joanne's here. Johan's there. Scott is there. Ken or Tina, Tatiana, Peter, Tori.
Hello.
Yep, I'm back here.
Hello.
Hello.
All right.
Ed, it's Michael. I'm on also.
Hi, Michael.
Hi.
Ed, it's Ken Jones.
Hey, Ken Jones.
How are you?
Yeah, I was talking to Gantz about you yesterday.
Oh, really? Gantz is a fabulous guy. What's that?
Excellent man.
Yeah, he really is. And incredibly talented and has a lovely young daughter.
Yeah, two of them.
Two of them? I only know one.
Two.
That's great.
All right, so is Tina going to be on?
Yeah, she's just getting off another conference call.
Okay, but, Claire Coles?
Hey, this is Claire.
Jeff? Hey, Claire. Jeff?
Not here. This is Jeff.
All right. Tatiana or Peter? Kazoo? Bill Barnett?
I'm here.
Kathy Mitchell? John Hannigan? Sarah Joe?
I'm here.
Sarah Jo.
Yeah. Still trying to load WebEx, but other than that.
Okay. Well, if anyone else joins us, we'll know about it. So.
This is Therese Grant.
Hi, Therese. How are you?
Good. Thanks. Hi, this is Kaze, 3048.
Okay. God, big day today. Everybody's making it.
Hello?
Hello?
Hi.
And
who's that? Oh, it's Tatiana, sorry.
Oh. All right, so the only one is Tita and Peter. And Kathy Mitchell and John Hannigan. So, anyone I missed? Raj, Leah? So our face-to-face meeting is going to be held in Rockville, AAA terrace level conference rooms on the 5th and 6th of February. I know people will be traveling in on the 4th, which is Super Bowl Sunday. Jill informs me that the hotel will likely have a projection screen of the game, or that there are sports bars nearby if anyone's interested in getting there in time for the game. The sleeping rooms are going to be $170 a night. And Jill, I guess, will be sending out confirmation or how you should go about booking those if she hasn't done that already.
Hi, it's Jill. Let me just type in real quick. So I'll send out the confirmation list based on the Google form that I collected. If you have any modifications, please let me know today because I'll be securing that contract up with them tomorrow.
Okay, and try not to make your flights earlier than like 5 o'clock, 6 o'clock. Probably 6 would be better. I know that it's traffic at that time, but I think we're going to need the time. So we'll finish up at 3. You figure it takes about 45 minutes to an hour to get to the airport. And so that'll get it 4. And so, you know, 5:30, 6 o'clock, you should be fine. Jill, you want to talk about the progress reports that we're going to need so that we can get it everybody in time?
Absolutely. So we're just going to take the RPPR format and do it in a Word document. So I'll make that template because normally you do your RPPR within the ERA Commons module, but rather than having two different formats for the progress reports moving forward, we're just going to have the one format. You will just be submitting the ones that are due not on the NIH timeline to me in Word. So I'll send out a template of that probably later today, if not tomorrow.
Okay. Each of the projects, as we've typically done in the past, will make a presentation at the face-to-face meeting. We'll put together a time frame for that, but as in the past, it's kind of what's been accomplished and where you're going with the project during the next reporting period. We will have guests at this meeting. We're formalizing or trying to arrange that now. So hopefully the face-to-face will go smooth and we won't get snowed in or out. And go from there. Everyone who was at the reverse site visit knows what I'm talking about. All right,
any idea who the invited guests are going to be, Ed?
We're working on someone to talk about slipping my mind words. I'm having
data sharing.
Brain freeze these days. The data sharing policy of and how one goes about doing that, what is required. Hopefully we'll have someone there on that, and other ones are just kind of still up in the air.
Okay.
But am I forgetting someone, Jill?
No, but if you have any ideas, you can still send them our way.
Yeah. So, you know, and we try to bring in people who will participate with the whole group. We are bringing in someone from Holland, which is...
He's from Belgium.
Belgium, okay. And he is going to... He does 3D facial imaging similar to Peter, but he's going to become a consultant on Peter's project, we hope. And we wanted people to meet him and get a chance to talk with him. And that kind of eats up a lot of our travel budget. So between him and Mike Suddy, bringing two people in from Europe is a little costly. But it has to be done, so.
Absolutely, right. Ed, we're paying for Mike.
Oh, great. So, and the ideas are welcome. And welcome to the call, Peter. I didn't have you down there. All right. Michael, do you want to give an update on the RSA symposium?
Yeah, the RSA symposium has been submitted. We expect to hear back in February. We've identified four people, Scott, Johan, myself, and Tatiana, for a submission for an ISPRA symposium. The ISPRA website shows us to start submitting now, but it doesn't actually have any information about deadlines or format. So I think that's probably still under construction.
So that, I'm sorry, that's the ISPRA one you were talking about.
Right, so RSA has been submitted and we'll hear back about that in February.
Okay, and that's Parnell, Setti, Weinberg, and Chambers. And you and I is discussing, I guess.
That's correct.
Okay. All right, and for the abstracts that are being submitted for RSA, it would be nice if it, somewhere on there you acknowledge the CFAS's contribution to the project, even if it's not a multiple site project. If it comes off of these U01, U24 grants, CFAS should be mentioned in the acknowledgments at least. Jennifer.
Hi, Hannigan just showed up. Sorry I'm late.
That's all right, John. Okay.
And someone sounds like they're in a waiting room. If you can mute, that would be great.
Jennifer, you have...
Oh, I just have a quick reminder. So if you go to the CFAST website, under the research tab, we have descriptions of all the projects. And contained within that, we have pictures of the PIs, links to their pages, some slide examples that kind of summarize their projects, as well as lay descriptions. If you can go to the CFAST website, go to the research tab, and take a look at projects and make sure that yours is not missing any information, that would be great. There are a few projects that just have a few things that we need still. That's it.
Okie doke. Tatiana, are there any updates on the publication committee?
No. No, we don't. I'm going to have a different question at some point. But.
Okay. And Bill, on the data access committee, I know you guys have been... I mean, a couple.
Yeah, so we have, we revised the policy and refined and approved the intake process and review process for external investigator requests. And I think pretty much everybody on the data access committee has approved those. And we are at the place now where I'm doing the administrative review of the first proposal, Mark DeLucinet's proposal. A couple more data items he's got to provide, and then I'll be able to send that off to the committee to review. So we made a lot of progress in the last month.
Okay. One administrative type of thing is Tom Blanchard, who was a PI on a UH2 project, has been taken over a directorship of the Brain Bank. There and is requesting Sandra Mooney become the PI. She was a co-investigator on that project. I think most of us probably know Sandra. That still has to go through official NIH channels, but I'm hoping that there won't be any problem. And Tom will still be involved in the microbiome project. He just feels administratively it would be better in Sandra's hands. So... hopefully that'll go through without any real problems, just as a change in PI. And Teresa Grant's also on, and as you know, she's the co-investigator in Claire Coles' aging grant. So, and I heard Bill Dunty, you might, if there is a new RFA out on possibilities for adults?
Well, we reissued
a few days ago, the Developmental Origins in Health and Disease, the DOED, program announcements that we had out for the last 3 years. There's an R01 and an R21 version. They were out for 3 years, and then there was a period of a couple months where that those program announcements lapsed. But they were reissued on Tuesday, I believe.
Okay. So that's something that may want to consider, you know, adding on to, or since you're going to have, you know, a bunch of adults. So.
Yeah. So if anyone's interested, just let me know, or I can send those links to Jill. She can distribute them.
That would be great. All right. So we have two presentations today. Claire is going to present, and with Teresa Grant, I believe, and then Christy and Cristiano will do the second one. So, Claire, are you ready to? I see that Jill has on the screen. The publication progress in the last month, with Julie Cable having two papers in concept and Joanne having one manuscript under submission. So congratulations, and I hope everything comes to publication fruition soon. All right, Claire, can you get the screen?
Jill has to tell me how to get this to show on the screen.
No problem. At the top, you'll see some tabs. One of them on the left is called Quick Start.
I don't see that.
In the Cisco WebEx Meeting Center box,
yes. Mm-hmm.
On the left, it says Quick Start.
Yep, got it.
And then in the center, there's some circles. In the center circle, hit Share Screen.
Done
that. There you go.
Okay.
Oh, okay, you got it?
Yeah, just go to slideshow and a larger screen.
There we go. Does that work? Yes. Terrific. All right.
No, that's not it. Now we see your presentation.
See what?
We see the your...
It's gone to the wrong screen.
The presenter screen, yeah.
Wait a minute. Oh, it's not going to the right screen. I hit the wrong
button. It's okay. Everyone can just, on the top, there are some magnifying glasses. You can just click the magnifying glass to make your screen bigger.
Oh, okay.
Okay. Is it okay? Can everybody see?
Yeah, it works for me.
Okay. Yeah. All right, well, I'll figure this out in the future. Basically, this is talking about our project, which is called Fetal Alcohol Spectrum Disorder in Adults, Health and Neurobehavior. And it is a collaboration among myself, Dr. Grant in Seattle, and with Dr. Riley as the collaborator, as a consultant. And then we are also doing this in parallel with Joanne Weinberg in British Columbia, who is going to essentially do the same process with a sample that she has in separately. So the whole goal of this is to look at the effects in adults, in mature adults, which has never been evaluated. So we really don't know much about the long-term effects of prenatal exposure and what the course over the lifespan is. We assume that there might be some changes or differences or alterations over time, but we really don't know anything about that. And one of the reasons that this is so relevant is the developmental origins of health and disease hypothesis, which has been demonstrated to... which has demonstrated that things that happen prenatally produce something called fetal programming and leads to later health issues among adults, particularly as the population ages. And it is hard to imagine that a teratogen as significant as alcohol would not have some effect over time. So one of the goals of our approach is to see...
Claire, can I interrupt you just a second? Somebody is typing. Thank
they
you.
They should put their things on mute. Thank you. There's always that. That's what the trouble with conference calls. But anyway, so we think that there should be some effects, and we are doing sort of a broad-scale evaluation of adults in order to see whether or not we can identify these differences. Okay. The study, as I mentioned, is a multi-site collaborative study, and the sites are Atlanta, Georgia, Seattle, Washington, with a parallel study going on in Vancouver. It's designed as a two-tier assessment of these issues. One is a demographic and health survey, Tier 1, and the second, Tier 2, is an in-depth assessment that will include assessment of medical records, physical characteristics, immune function, mental health, cognitive function, and social adaptive function in this group of individuals. Tier 1, we are trying to access 500 individuals at between Atlanta and Seattle, with another 120 to be identified in Vancouver using the same form. We have the major data input for this is going to be the adult health survey. And in Atlanta, this is going to be called the Emory Adult Health Study. And Therese may be able to tell you what she's decided to call it in Seattle. And we're looking at access to health care, chronic medical problems in midlife. And we have a number of different health care issues that we're going to address. And these are things which we think are relevant to health in general, but also probably related to what might be the outcome of effects of alcohol. Since nobody knows anything about this, or there's just so little research, we've done really sort of a overview type approach rather than zeroing in narrowly on one particular area. The Tier 2 assessment is intended to be an in-depth assessment, as I mentioned, looking at physical characteristics, psychology, psychological factors, environmental issues which might impact these things, substance use, since this seems to be a highly likely issue in this group, and health, including immune function. 120 individuals will be recruited at each site for 240 total, and again for another 120 in Vancouver. They'll be invited to the study site for each one of our sites, and they'll spend about 4 hours being evaluated and completing questionnaires. We will also do a physical exam, drawing blood and taking urine samples, and this is designed to confirm the substance use reports that we'll get from the individuals, to assess metabolic status, since, again, we suspect that there might be a higher incidence of diabetes, look at liver function and immune status. And here are the measures that will be used in the Tier 2 assessment. We're going to use the NIH toolbox to get a cognitive functioning. And this we're essentially looking at fluid intelligence. A fluid intelligence being mostly nonverbal, and the goal being to identify the kinds of cognition that are more likely to become deficit over time. And as you I certainly know, over time, one's reaction time and other aspects of fluid intelligence become impaired, and we should see a drop-off by this age if there's going to be one. We also will look at adaptive functioning using the Adaptive Behavior Assessment System, psychiatric problems, since we believe that mental health issues should be common among this group, substance use issues. We'll use both the audit, which is a measure that looks at substance risky alcohol and drug use, a drug grid, which is essentially just asking what you're using among quite a lot of drugs, and then we'll do lab tests, which will determine the use of 8 different drugs, plus liver function related to alcohol use. And we will also get a measure of life stressors and resources. In terms of the physical assessment to be done at this time, we will do a dysmorphology assessment, which will include an evaluation by Ken Jones. We plan to take 2D photography and collaborate with Peter Hammond in doing this. Emory is kicking up a tiny bit of a fuss about this right now, but we will work out the materials transfer for this. Urine toxicology will be done. As I said, the GGT, the A1C for diabetes. We will draw bloods for immune measures, which will be sent to Joanne Weinberg, and we, thank goodness, have completed the materials transfer, or most of it, for that. And we will also try to determine health history by abstracting current medical records. We believe that that will be a much easier process in Vancouver than it will be in Atlanta, but because of the nature of the healthcare system, but we will give it our best shot. In terms of progress, we've spent the last 6 months with various administrative hassles trying to coordinate among the three sites to develop materials that are consistent with what everybody needs, doing these transfer agreements, getting all IRB approval, reviewing the assessment protocol be assured that this is what we really want, and purchasing materials, developing assessment tools and databases in REDCap. I assume everybody's familiar with REDCap, but if not, it's a database that's interactive and that's HIPAA compliant and is very flexible in terms of how it can be used and allows rather efficient data entry and storage. And we've also begun searching databases for previous participants who will be invited to participate in the current study. One of the big things we did was develop a health questionnaire. This is a screenshot from REDCap. This is not how it would look to the participants. I've actually sent Ed and Therese and Joanne how it would look in REDCap, and it's neat because it looks quite nice, and also you can do it on your phone, which is fun. So it's really sort of an app, but it was based originally on the Centers for Disease Control's Behavioral Risk Factor Surveillance System questionnaires, which come out each year. However, we adapted it for the needs of this particular project, and we had to add a number of modules, and we added modules on vision, hearing, dental problems, seizure disorders, immune disorders, and so on. It was developed in combination among all three sites. And as I said, it was developed using REDCap. It can be accessed either on computer or smartphone and can be completed by the participant either directly or through interview. It's confidential and HIPAA compliant, and it converts directly into an interactive database. You also can do multi-site access, so we can have one site where these things are stored, and it can be accessed from several sites. And we did pilot this in Atlanta last weekend, actually, and we found that the questionnaire, which works absolutely beautifully with all of us and takes only about 20 minutes to complete, is much more of a challenge for people who are impaired or who don't read well. So we anticipate that there will be some people who can complete this over the on the computer or over the phone, but there's going to be others who have to be worked with one-on-one in order to get things completed, which we had anticipated in general. The next issue is identification of potential participants. And, of course, for this study, we are looking for 500 in Tier 1 and 240 in Tier 2, plus those who will be in Vancouver. And we've been acting independently in Atlanta. We've accessed databases from previous study waves, accumulated names, addresses, social security numbers, et cetera. We've contracted with AcuraNet to allow computerized search for participants' current address. And we have currently located 60 previous participants. And after the first of the year, when all the IRB stuff is done, we'll begin recruiting them into the study. And Therese, maybe you'd like to talk about what you've done in Seattle.
Yeah, thanks, Claire. We have, as Claire had said, we're developing these materials in parallel with Claire and Joanne. So it's been really a really good collaborative process. So we started searching for these people last year before we made the grant application. And currently we have good information for locations of 125 previous participants. And so far, actually, this slide says 65, but as of last night, 71 people have said, yes, they're interested in another study, and give me a call as soon as everything's ready to go. So we feel pretty confident that over the life of the grant we'll be able to get our number for Tier 1 and certainly the 120 in Seattle for Tier 2. One of our biggest challenges right now, we're using TLO, which is it's called TransUnion, and it's a computerized database that does a great job of finding people. The problem is a lot of people, of course, have moved out of the area, and also people are using cell phones. They don't have, you know, there's no white pages anymore. So I think it will get more difficult as we get past this first level of easier to find people, but we're getting pretty good at it.
Yeah, and that's why I put the green box in the middle. So there are potential problems for recruitment success, which we're very aware of. There's participant mobility. People may have moved out of the area. Now, that may not be a problem for Tier 1 because we can do it over the phone. It's going to be a problem for Tier 2, so that's going to limit the people who can be recruited. And as Tree says, they don't have phone books anymore. Cell phones don't have white pages, and everybody has a cell phone. So particularly, and some of the phones are not smartphones, too, among people who are not wealthy. The other issue is privacy concerns. People have become much more worried about privacy than they were previously, and sometimes they don't answer the phone. And some may not be interested in participating. So, you know, there are things that are going to limit the number of people we can get, but we are chugging away at it. We'll see. Probably we'll know more about this as time passes. Finally, our timeline. This is now December 2017. We've completed administrative requirements, developed forms, recruitment materials. In January, it should say 18, not 17, I apologize. We're going to initiate recruitment, the health surveys, and the registry, which will include those people who wish to be contacted for future research. And then Tier 2, from January to May, we'll obtain all materials, permissions, and identify the initial sample to be recruited for that. And in July, we plan to begin the Tier 2 assessments. So that's all I have. Any questions?
Yeah, I have a question, Claire. I don't know whether there's any way of looking at this, but I'm really interested in the issue of whether individuals with FAS or an FASD become or are rehabilitational as they get older. And I'm talking about people in prison.
Oh, well, it is possible to look and see who's in prison, if that's what you want.
Well, no. The question is, as it turns out, a lot of people feel that individuals with a fetal alcohol spectrum disorder, and I'm talking now about judges, feel that these people are not, they cannot be rehabilitated, and therefore, what's that?
I said that makes no sense, but go on.
Well, what I would like to be able to do is challenge that.
Mm-hmm.
Because it has a huge effect on their sentence.
Well, there's two things I can say. One is that, as you may or may not be aware, there are databases showing who is in jail and who's been adjudicated to the justice system. So it would be possible to determine among all of these people who has either is in prison or has been in prison. And we certainly could look to see what happened to them. It's sort of a sub-study, but maybe that's...
Well, I was thinking about it. I was thinking about it more. Can't psychological testing in some way look at issues of one's ability to be rehabilitated as an adult?
Would that that were the case, Ken.
No.
In fact, psychology is terrible at determining and predicting the future in terms of legal issues. The way you determine rehabilitation would be how long are they stayed out of jail, do they have a job, are they functioning in society,
right.
Which we will know. We can know that if any of the people we interact with. I don't know if you read our last paper, but a number of the people that are in our sample, some huge number of them have had dealings with the law.
Right.
we could certainly, you know, access that information and determine what happened to them.
Yeah. Well, I guess that might partially answer the question. I'm sort of thinking of a guy who's been in jail for 25 years and is still in jail, and somebody is trying to get him his sentence changed, mitigation. Mm-hmm. And in some states, Alabama is a perfect example that I'm particularly familiar with as far as this is concerned. The concept is that these people are beyond any ability to be rehabilitated, and therefore we'll just keep them in jail.
Yike.
And there's no way. What you're saying is there's no way to look at that.
Well, it's like an
R21.
Yeah, that's an R21, and it would be a good thing to write a grant about. I am not a person who does forensic psychology, although
uh-huh.
there are people who do, and I could access somebody, this guy down the hall who does it, and perhaps become better informed about how to evaluate this kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
There's
okay.
a Canadian psychiatrist is a forensic psychiatrist who
mm-hmm.
has a few case reports on
mm-hmm.
People with FAS and being released.
Uh-huh.
Mm-hmm.
His name is Mega, I believe, M-E-G-A.
Okay, thanks.
But, I mean, I think that could be evaluated, and because we had such a large number of people who did have trouble with the law in our 22-year sample, it might be a good population to investigate what happened to them.
Gotcha. Okay.
And what characteristics predicted it.
Okay, thanks.
Teresa,
in the sample that you looked at over, you know, last year, well, I think there was only one person who was in prison, right?
Yeah, but we hadn't contacted all 433 at that time. We were pretty much, looking. Yeah. So.
But it was like one out of 100 or something. It wasn't,
yeah, one out of like 125, something like that.
It wasn't this traumatic, even though some of them probably had trouble with the law growing up.
Right.
That's one.
That's what I would be interested in asking, and I can't remember, Claire, if this is on our questions right now, but asking in our study if they were in jail previously and for what, because that would tell us who's not in jail right now and what kinds of characteristics they had. You know, what helped them get out of jail, or it depends on how serious the crime was.
Right.
Yeah. It needs to be investigated more. I mean, we could have another conference call offline and get something developed on this, I think, because there's certainly data on it. You've got a huge issue. Like, my population are African Americans, and they're poor, and those people end up in jail like 25% of the whole population, no matter whether they were alcohol exposed or not.
Right.
All right.
So,
you know, I think it is a great topic for a future conversation. Maybe getting some of the lawyers that everybody knows involved in it as well. We could have
mm-hmm. be very interesting
thing on that, because
mm-hmm.
there certainly is a lot of interest in the legal outcomes here.
Yeah.
But I want to move on now and get Chris.
Before you do, Ed, can I just throw out one more name? For 10, and that's Julie Connery here in Vancouver.
How do you spell her last name?
C-O-N-R-Y, Julie Connery.
Thanks.
And her expertise is in FASD and the justice system.
Great,
so
thanks.
She's actually retired if you need more information on how to contact her, but she's still active, with the Asante Center here. But just contact me, and I'll get you more information on her if you need it.
Thanks a lot.
Okay, so now we need to share the screen or share to Bill?
Real quick question. Claire, I'm sorry if I missed this, but will you be banking blood samples?
We're not banking blood samples. We're drawing blood samples, and we're sending them to Joanne.
Joanne, are you going to bank them?
I'm sorry?
Are you going to bank?
I'm wondering
blood samples?
Yeah, if it makes sense in the future, if you want to, reassess something in the blood that we haven't thought about will there be enough blood to bank them and potentially test them later on?
Well, we can talk about doing that.
Yeah, there can be. We'll take a blood sample enough to aliquot it out into several aliquots. We only need one of those to run the cytokines. But let's talk about that as well offline in terms of how much blood to take and how to spin it down and aliquot it out.
Let's make it a topic for the face-to-face meeting.
Okay,
okay, let's do that.
Important.
That'd be great.
All righty.
Great idea.
Got about 20 minutes from to go, and so I want to give Christy and Cristiano a chance to talk about their e-health involvement here, mobile health.
Great.
You're on, Christy.
Yep. Can you guys just see our main screen?
Which screen can you see them at, Jeff?
We have a lot of screens in our office right now, so
yeah.
Do you just see a whole slide, or do you see the presenter view?
We see everything.
Yep.
We see the whole, all of your slides.
The slide's really all right, small.
Yeah, you don't
we
see our notes.
We see 1-8 at the bottom.
Okay. Oh, they see this.
Oh, they see this?
Yeah.
Oh, this is this.
Okay.
What about now?
Okay. Okay. Okay, great. We just have a lot of screens here.
Yep.
Okay, so I want to start by introducing our team. You have met Cristiano and I, of course. Also joining our team is Heather Carmichael Olson, who many of you may know from the University of Washington. We also have Wendy Heiselman and Zhao Duan from the Department of Electrical and Computer Engineering here at the University of Rochester. Wendy is the Dean of the School of Engineering and has worked with Cristiano on the Manage My Condition framework that he's using to help build the app. Zhao will be taking the lead on some of our data analytics and machine learning. We're having some technical difficulties here, but we'll move forward. Also, we have Jen Carr, who's our fantastic research coordinator, and Rebecca Van Dyke, who's a master's student in computer engineering. All right. So I am going to start by showing you just some of the components that we have of our app to help set the context for the remainder of the presentation. So what you see here on the screen is our current, hold on, do you guys still see our screen? Okay, there we go. We're just, I think we're doing all right. We'll just make it work. Okay, so here's, we're having some problems with WebEx.
Yeah. One of the connectors. I don't know if it's the connector.
Do you guys still see what the main screen?
Yes.
But we see it in.
Let's just do the.
Not in slideshow.
Load page.
We're simplifying our presentation.
Yeah. Let's see if we can get to this.
Okay, are we back on?
Which one can sync it into the desk?
There.
All right.
Now
we're
there.
Sorry.
Okay, sorry about that.
Okay, so here's a quick visual representation of the components of the app so you have context for the rest of the presentation. What you see first is the learning module. This is sort of the full context of the app. There are 12 core modules with 3 levels that you can kind of see here on the sign. This will include the text and audio that provides the psychoeducation. There will also be exercises to practice the learning content, and as well as animations and videos to help teach that. Next, we have the family forum. This is where users can share ideas, ask questions, and get support. It's organized into sub-forums, and there are also trained peer moderators that help facilitate communication. There's also a library that we're developing that includes lists of books, websites, and other resources for families, and as well as optional fact sheets that we are developing. Their app will also include a component called the notebook, where the user essentially is building a personalized reference for themselves
including things that they find in some of the learning modules or libraries that they really like. They can kind of star those, and those will get pulled into their notebook for later reference. Also, some of the exercises they complete about their child, as well as some of the tools that we're developing, all of those things are organized in their notebook. There's also the dashboard, which provides a summary of progress, things like badges earned, the behavior ratings, usage metrics, and Christiana will do a little bit more showing you what our interface looks like for those a little bit later. Okay, so here is an overview of our project timeline. In years 1 and 2, we're focusing on the systematic development of the app, including getting iterative feedback from parents and caregivers in focus groups. And we're looking forward at the end to showing you a little bit some of our prelim data from our first round that we did earlier this month. In addition to our weekly team meetings, we also have two what we're calling intensive app development retreats per year, where Heather travels from Seattle to Rochester for some intensive in-person work. We had our first retreat in September, and our second one is scheduled for the end of February, and we make great progress in those settings. We also have set our developmental benchmarks, and we're well on track to meet these. These are in line with the ones that we sent to Jill to put in the spreadsheet for our monthly meetings. We are planning to test the, or have the initial full prototype done by the beginning of March 2019, and we'll have selected parents try it out at home for an initial test. In year 3, we'll conduct a larger feasibility trial, including aiming to have about 30 parents recruiting through the web portal and also administering some of our pre-post measures to ensure that those work for the larger trial that we will conduct in years 4 and 5. So next, I'd like to share how we've approached developing the content of the app. So we began with the standard Family Moving Forward program, which is a tailored intervention developed by Heather Carmichael Olson and her team at the University of Washington and Seattle Children's Research Institute, which was originally funded by the CDC. So FMS is about a 15-plus session program delivered by a trained mental health specialist. And we're pretty familiar with this program in Rochester as we've been implementing and researching it since about 2013. For this specific project, we're creating what's called a derivative product of the standard FMS program, which also integrates new features and has the advantage of being versatile and much more scalable. The learning content, principles, and the methods have actually translated pretty remarkably smoothly into the app format, but it's also been a pretty complex process as we have figured this out. Let's see. So we've considered a lot how to translate the body of this content. And one of the things that we've thought quite a bit about is, and it's particularly relevant when thinking about how to translate some of those techniques that the FMS specialist does to teach and support parents in learning and implementing the content in their FMS. I mean, obviously you're not going to translate those directly in the same way, but we've been thinking a lot about how the app might be successful at teaching some of these same concepts. And while the content is actually largely similar or the same, the intervention flow or sort of the sequence and how we teach the content in the app is somewhat different. We've also consulted with various experts and literatures from multiple fields to help inform our development. So, for example, we consulted a local expert here at the University of Rochester at online learning, and he advised us in using what's called a backward design process to figure out sort of how to best develop the learning experiences and instructional techniques for the app. And essentially, backward design involves kind of starting with your end goals or sort of your primary outcomes in mind and thinking about how you would assess those and knowing you've achieved them and then figuring out how the specific techniques will go on to that. And so we looked a lot at things like Bloom's taxonomy and making sure we were hitting the right level to help people advance in a steady progress. Heather and I also attended a conference on implementation science and thought a lot about the kinds of factors that might facilitate or impede implementation of the app by the user. We've also carefully thought through some of the specific behavior change techniques we're using in the app to help achieve the desired aims. We also initiated consultation with one of our independent safety monitoring board committee members who has expertise in ethical use of technology in prevention intervention trials. So this is all going quite well. So in terms of hard progress, we have drafted all 12 core modules at this point, which is about 100 pages when you're looking at a PDF. We completed the first round of intense editing, which Heather took about over 64 hours to do over the course of a month or two. We're making those revisions, and I anticipate by the end of the week having the revisions done. We're also drafting optional content and compiling materials for the library. Next, we're planning to do our second round of intense editing for the core content and begin reviewing our optional materials. Next, Christiana will begin programming the content and exercises into the app. We'll be eliciting feedback on the content in focus groups and also scripting and producing audio-visual content that will go into the app. Now I'm going to transition over to Christiana to tell us a little bit more about the technology aspect of development.
So yes, I want to share with briefly what are the six steps that we follow in order to design and program the app itself, which are more general steps that everybody that develops a new app actually takes. And you can see the schematics here, but then I'm going to guide you through the different components. But it is that you start with an app, then you develop, you find what are the content and what are the functionalities that you want to offer. You get an initial interface design of what you want the app to look like. You go through the development of an interactive prototype. And then you go through what is the actual development phase, where you, there is a back and forth between a refinement of the interface that you're designing and the actual development, which involves the actual coding on the device of the app that you're making. So for our, in our specific case, the app idea was actually we submitted during the proposal and then in the grant itself, so everything was consolidated at that particular time. Second step was actually defining what are the different components and the functionalities that we wanted to provide to the user through our app. And it is most of these were actually established by the time that we actually were submitted the grant. But while when we started working on the project during the weekly meetings that we had, and also then when we actually did the focus group with families, we refined a little bit what we want to offer in order to build up the different components that you want to offer. And you can see in the picture there the five components that Christy discussed and described in the beginning. And there is also the initial, the additional part, which is a different functionalities that we want to offer, like reminders, sort of synchronization across devices, security functionalities. So basically ironing out all the different components and things that you want your app to be able to do as support for the user itself. The next step is the interface design. This is what the SAS usually is a responsibility of the graphic designer. This is something that we don't have the budget for a graphic designer. We don't have a graphic designer in the team, so I had to invent myself and being also a graphic designer for this. And they have this thing in Italy for construction that you go to an architect if you want a nice house, and you go to an engineer if you want a house to actually last and stay out. So more or less you can translate this for app development. So an engineer makes things to work, and a graphic designer should make them look nice. Hopefully these are nice enough for what we want to do. So for this, it is that you convert all the different components and functionality into a set of screens, images, that is basically what is going to go inside the phone whenever you're implementing. We use Sketch for this. You're probably more familiar, or at least you heard about Photoshop as a program for drawing lines, shapes, combining different elements into objects that actually then make the screens that you're going to be seeing on the phone and within the app. The next step, as soon as you define the idea, the functionalities, and then you have the design, is to find a, create a sort of hyperlink between the different screens that we designed in the previous step, which is the idea of physically trying to simulate what's the behavior of a user that is going through the app and linking different components together. And for this, we use InVision, which is a product that's through a website that provides you an easy way to actually connecting between each other and different screens. And I want to show you briefly what we have, if I'm able to open the other screen and share it with you. I don't know where it did it go. Let's see if I can go.
I don't know where it's going. Yeah, let's see if I can see it now. Can you see a big phone now?
Yes.
Okay, perfect. So the idea is with this website, you are actually uploading all the different screens that we made in the previous step, and there are easy ways for actually interconnecting the different screens together. And an idea is, I don't know what this one is going on. So whenever you can design the initial screen and which is what the phone is going to look like, make it smaller so that you can see everything, and you can see the icon now with our logo for the app. You click in there, you can see this is the main screen, which is what Christy was showing you in the beginning. Then you can navigate through the app like if you're using a real app. So for example, there are these three different modules, different levels that we have. You can click in one, you can see what the user is going to be represented whenever it's going to click level one, and you have the sequence of the different modules. Then, for example, taking action, same things for the second level, and so forth for the last level up here. And it is as you click through, you can see, you know, we have the other component with the forum, so you can see what we are envisioning as the different categories, so you can show the other teammates and also potentially to the potential user what that app is going to look like so that they can try and test it before you actually go into the implementation. So for example, for the forum, we're envisioning it has been organized in different sub-forums. Then you go through it, you're going to see the list of different posts. And for each one of the posts, you can see the main post and then a series of replies after the post itself. So basically, you can go through and see what the different components are going to look like in an easy and interactive way that you can test through. So this is what the fourth step. Next step is actually when the fun begins, if you want, because that's where at least from a programming point of view, that's where the fun begins. Because you can actually take all the lessons learned that you learned through the interface design and then through the interactive prototypes that I just showed you. You can use this for a focus group and getting feedback on that. And the next step is actually a continuous back and forth between interface refinement, where you are consolidating the app appearance, you're creating a coherent and consistent look and feel throughout the app. And then you can see on the right side of the slide the actual development itself, where you're basically taking what is the screens that you make on the interface design and interface refinement, and you're actually adding some coding on top of it, which is providing the functionality that actually implementing or writing the code that does the functionality that we want to offer to the different users. So from a programming point of view, we had a series of requirements. An important thing was having a cross-platform, so providing apps both for iOS and Android. And through some of the focus groups, some of the people that attended the focus group actually suggested us for going also for a web type of application where they can just browse them using their computer. And that's something that we're probably going to consider going forward. And then some of the functionality, which are generic functionality of security, authentication, real-time synchronization across devices, potential of sending push notification, which is those annoying things that actually pop up on your phone whenever someone is texting you or something. And for this step, we didn't want to go through reinventing the wheel itself, so we're basing all of our development on open source products, and we're using Google Firebase, Research Kit and CareKit from Apple, Research Stack, which is another open source program for slightly different functionality, and Manage the Condition, which is the actual framework that I developed the previous one. So where are we now from the R programming? So you saw that we have the initial phases are there. We have the interactive prototype. We started using the interactive prototype for focus groups. And now we are in that stage where we are going back and forth between interface refinement and actual development. And we have an initial implementation of the prototype into iOS. And in collaboration with the graduate student who is working with me on the project, we are working on the functionality of the forum itself, which is probably the most intense component from an engineering point of view. And for this one, we have the initial cloud infrastructure, authentication, some of the read and write operation,
and synchronization across devices, but we're still working on matching entirely what we are proposing with the interactive prototype with the actual app. So now I'm going to pass it back to Chrissy.
And I'll be, I know we're getting pretty close to time, so I'm going to just go through these pretty quickly. So as I mentioned earlier, we're collecting some systematic qualitative data to inform the development of the app, where we're going to be looking for diverse perspectives, including on key variables such as family structure, comfort with technology, location, child age, and whatnot. We started our first group this month on the first week of December. Where we focused on getting feedback on the app structure and interface design. We also are planning some future groups that will include interaction with specific aspects of the app and looking at how easy it is for them to use, feedback on the content design, and satisfaction with the experience. I've also reached out to some other PIs in PFAS to look at the possibility of running groups in their area, given that there's quite a bit of variability in access to services and experiences of families, and we want to make sure we're really covering exposure. We also have families in Rochester who have done the standard FMS program, and so I think there's the advantage of asking their input as well. And as we collect the data, we'll be doing some systematic thematic analysis, looking at similarities and differences on the key variables. And we're conceptualizing at least one paper that will come from this focus group data and detailing kind of the process and what's important to users in the app. Here's just some preliminary findings that you might be interested in from our first group. Again, this isn't systematically analyzed at this point, but this is just some early themes that came out. The users felt really strongly that they should be able to use the app indefinitely and return to helpful content and engage with the forum, even if they've done all the learning modules. They liked that they could save in content that they were particularly interested in to their notebook for later reference. They liked the tools that we suggested, and they came up with some additional ideas that we're considering. Within the family forum, some big themes that came up were trust, confidentiality, and protection. They suggested that the sub-forums become introduced as users complete relevant learning modules. They also like the idea of having sub-forums available for geographic location, so they really facilitate some of the sharing of resources and advocacy tips that are more regional. And they wanted an easy way to aggregate and find tips and resources suggested by other users. And finally, in terms of the app interface design, they had a strong positive reaction to the learning module interface. They were sort of less enthusiastic about the logo or icon, but were generally neutral to positive. They gave us some ideas that we're playing around with. In our interface design, we showed both graphics and photos to get an idea of what they liked better, and they preferred graphics. We also asked them what are some things that might make them likely to be motivated to use the app, and they felt that if their child was struggling, they would be more likely to use the app, and as well, they were really motivated by the potential to connect with other users. Things like being able to do voice to text or audio record were motivating for some families who prefer not to type in their phone. And also,
someone mute their phone, please. Someone mute their phone. You're getting a lot of crosstalk.
They also wanted the ability to go across platforms, for example, going from their phone to their computer so that they could do more, read easier or type more. Things that they perceived as being a barrier to people using the app, if they felt the forum was poorly moderated or that there wasn't the trust and safety that they would feel comfortable posting. They also highlighted difficulties with technology that could be barriers, such as difficulty to navigate the app, lots of scrolling and slow load time. So thank you for your patience with our WebEx.
I know it's late, but if there are any questions or comments, ask away. Christy, the only thing I can say is that you've done a great job, and if there's anything the administrative core can help with, to let me know, because I noticed that you really don't get start collecting real data until the end of year 4 and 5. And
well, and I guess it's depending on what you consider real data, because qualitative data has a lot of advantages. But.
No, I mean in getting the app out there to real parents to use in a real-life setting. And the reason I just bring it up is that the renewal will be due in the fourth year. And you're going to need to show that, you know, progress was made.
We do have on our third year the feasibility trial with 30 families where they'll use it for a good 3 or 4 month period and collect data. We'll have data, the pre and post data at the third year.
Okay.
Like I hate.
But anything the admin core can do to help, and that includes like Gantz, if he has any, you know, comments or whatever, let me know.
Okay. That'd be great.
Anything else? Okay,
thanks
then.
Just today.
Email Jennifer any news about it, and make sure your publications are posted the proper place in terms of where you are in tone publication. And our next call will be January 24th, and everybody have a tremendous and happy holiday.
You too.
You too.
Thank you.
Happy holidays.
Thank you too, Ed. Thanks.
Happy holidays.
Thank you. Happy holidays.
Take care now.
Thanks to all of you.
Take care. Bye-bye.